Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking with Stephen Medvick, who's the author of In Defense of Politicians, The Expectations Trap, and Its Threat to Democracy. Stephen, how are you doing today?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm great. We've talked before in the context of your review for one of the journals, but this is a chance to talk to you about your own writing. So before we get to that, maybe you could reintroduce yourself, where you are, where you've been, and the way to set up the book.
Sure. I'm currently Associate Professor of Government at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I did my PhD at Purdue and taught at Old Dominion University in Virginia for about 5 years before moving to Franklin and Marshall.
Wonderful. This is also on a slightly different subject than you wrote that review. You know, this is also a subject very much in the news, and there are so many books out there that decry what's wrong with Washington.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to set out to do something a little different. You kind of offer a defense of Washington and of politicians. What motivated you to write the book? What was the initial urge to put this book out?
Well, I think there were kind of two motivations. One was maybe a little more abstract or theoretical, and the other was sort of just a daily kind of annoyance. So I'll start with the more theoretical, and that's just that I'm more and more concerned about the growing dissatisfaction with government and politics. I mean, of course, Americans have always been skeptical of government and distrustful of politicians, and to some extent that sort of skepticism is healthy in a democracy. But it seemed to me that this kind of blanket condemnation of all politics and all of government is becoming worse now than it's been in the past. Now, I don't have really strong evidence for that because I didn't do, you know, a historical analysis, or at least a lengthy historical analysis, but it just I just had that feeling. And my concern is that this distrust and this skepticism is turning into cynicism, which, of course, is really corrosive for government, for democracy, because it undermines the legitimacy of government. And so that was the kind of theoretical. The more day-to-day kind of annoyance was just hearing people, and this is friends and family members and neighbors, but also pundits and analysts who, you know, are knowledgeable about politics, hearing them, watching them on television, blame the dysfunction that they claim they see in politics on the bad behavior of politicians. And so that, you know, you hear things all the time like they're only concerned with re-election, or they're too partisan, or they're too ideological. And it struck me that this was a misunderstanding of the way our system of politics and government work. Or if it's not a misunderstanding, it's just naive. You know, it's a naive understanding. And so what I wanted to do was defend politicians in particular, but also remind people of how our system is designed.
Yeah, and the way you set this up is by talking about an expectations trap. It's in the title of your book.
Right.
So what are the trappings for the public of this expectations or not the right expectations? What is the expectations trap?
Yeah, so the expectations trap generally, the term that I coined for it, is that it's just the contradictory set of expectations that the public has for politicians. So they simultaneously want politicians to be contradictory things. And I kind of lay out a couple of different aspects of the trap. And so one, for example, is what I call the leader and follower trap. And so the public often wants politicians to lead. You know, they blame them or they condemn them for pandering to the public, you know, or watching public opinion polls. So they really want them to lead and do what's right, even if it's not popular. But, of course, the minute that they do that, they get blamed for being out of touch or for ignoring the will of the people or not being responsive to the public. So they want, it's hard for politicians to figure out which one they ought to be doing. Another one of the traps is the principled and pragmatic traps. So they want politicians who have a strong sense of values and a strong set of principles, and they want them to stand by those principles. You know, they don't want them to sell out, and yet they want them to compromise. Well, what they have to compromise on, if they're going to compromise, are their principles, right? And so they can't really do both at the same time. And then finally, I talk about the ordinary and exceptional trap. I think we want politicians to be exceptional in lots of ways, and there's pretty good evidence for this. You know, we want them to be extremely competent. We want them to be really honest and trustworthy. We want them to be empathetic. We want them to have all kinds of leadership skills that are probably not typical for most people. And yet we, you know, on the campaign trail, we put them through all kinds of indignities. We want them to be just like us, you know, the kind of person that we can have a beer with or something. And so they have to be able to hunt. They have to be able to bowl. They have to be able to milk a cow. And, you know, and so it's really difficult to find somebody who's really exceptional in lots of ways and sort of cut out for leadership, but then to be an ordinary, you know, Joe.
Right. And this isn't just the sort of the public in general. You also talk about kind of the punditry class as falling into this same trap. And one of the ways that you address this is by looking at the case study that you present in Chapter 5, which is of the 2011 debt ceiling debate, a debate that continues today. You argue that critics of the debate got things wrong. What did they get wrong? Did they get the same things wrong that the public gets wrong, or what did this case study allow you to do in the book to clarify this situation?
Sure. I think they did get it wrong in many of the same ways that the public gets it wrong. They seem to think that, you know, the problems that politicians are dealing with are simple things to solve. So, you know, so one example is that, and this is not a pundit, but, you know, the NFL lockout was happening during the 2011 debt ceiling crisis. And when it was solved, when it was finally resolved, the owner of the Patriots came out and said, well, I hope Washington takes a lesson from us, because dealing with the debt ceiling is a lot easier than dealing with the NFL lockout, which just on its face, I think, is absurd. But, you know, he's a smart guy. You would think he would know better. But even pundits who, you know, are on the cable talk shows, they'll say things like, you know, the four or five of us sitting around this table right now could solve this problem in, you know, in 30 minutes or something. Why is it taking the why are politicians behaving the way they're behaving? Why are they acting like children? They're acting stubborn. You know, why can't they solve the problem? But of course, I don't believe that four or five people, unless they completely agree on all aspects of the problem, I don't think even four or five people sitting around a table would really be able to solve a complicated problem like the debt or the debt ceiling. But even if they could, they're not responsible to anyone. They won't be held accountable for the decision they make. So they do what they think is best, and then they walk away. They don't have to worry about any fallout. Politicians, of course, in a democracy, in a representative form of government, have to answer to people for what they do. They have to listen to their constituents and do what not only what their constituents want them to do, but what they think is best. And lots of times those things are in conflict. So it's a much, much, much more complicated process than the pundits give it credit for.
Yeah. What you sort of come to in the book is that maybe some things could be done about this. But you suggest that simply electing better politicians, right, sort of the throw the bums out, mm-hmm. is not the solution. What are the solutions that you recommend in the book? What can be done about this, given that this is a not a new problem, this is a problem that's been going on a long time, and also that I think you suggest in the book, it's also kind of a human nature problem as well.
Sure.
What could be done? Are there any practical things that could be done to avoid this expectation trap, or to change the nature of our discourse to sort of recalibrate it around on more realistic expectations?
Well, of course, one thing that a professor is always going to argue is that, you know, better education would help. I mean, and I'm only sort of half joking about that. I mean, I really do think that if people sort of understood the complexity of the system and they recognized how the system's designed, they would realize that whether you like that design or not, the system's working pretty much as planned, as designed. Now, what that suggests is that once we understand what the what the design is like, if we wanted to undertake some kind of significant reform in that system, we could try to do that. Now, that's heavy lifting, and that would be very, very difficult. But I think that's one, you know, that's one way we might approach this. So, you know, one of the things I draw upon in the book is Aaron Leipert's discussion of the different forms of democracy, and he notes in his book Patterns of Democracy, which I think was on the podcast not long ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he points out that different combinations of institutions and processes will either encourage sharing of power, or they'll encourage the concentration of power. And most systems, most countries, decide to go full force one way or the other. So they all of the institutions and processes they put in place encourage sharing of power, or at least most of them. Or, on the other hand, some countries go in the direction of concentration of power. Well, one of the things you notice if you read Liebert closely is that in the United States we have almost a perfect mix of the two, so that lots of our systems, lots of our institutions are encouraged to share power. So the separation of powers, of course, is one. Federalism is another. But our electoral and our party system encourages the concentration of power. In other words, a two-party system is going to lead to majorities in the House, in the Senate, and even in the presidency, that think that they've been elected with a mandate, right? So the easy way to think of this is that our system creates majorities only to then thwart those majorities, right? It sets up majorities in the House, Senate, and the presidency and says, all right, now go to work, but we're going to separate powers and have checks and balances and make it nearly impossible for you to actually act on the electoral mandate that you got. So now, if people understood that, we could maybe change our electoral system and maybe go to something like proportional representation. Or we could change some of the institutions, you know, some of the separation of powers. Like, that one would be a far cry, I think, or a big stretch. But we could do that. We could undertake some serious constitutional reform if we wanted a system that either really encouraged compromise and sharing of power, or just let the majority, you know, work its will until the next election. I mean, I don't think we're likely to do that. But if the dysfunction that people see in our politics nowadays is the result of the design of our system, then that would be one way to solve it. But short of that, I think just understanding what the incentives in the system are would go a long way, because I think what pundits and the average person would do as a result is that they would cut politicians a break. They would say, look, I understand why you're doing what you're doing. I might disagree with it, but I'm not cynical about why you're doing what you're doing.
Have you had the book is recently out, but have you had any elected officials read the book, or if you talk to them about your perspective on this? The reason I ask the question is you often gather that many elected officials are just as guilty as the public is in general of viewing the job they hold in this peculiar kind of way, that the kind of almost self-hatred of their office leads many of them to complain about the very things that their constituents complain about. And some of that is just to get into this kind of public dialogue that is popular. But have you had that chance? And if not, what do you think the reaction would be of elected officials to your perspective and some of your recommendations?
Well, my sense is that many of them, kind of off the record, would say, you know, I appreciate the perspective because I'm doing the best I can here. You know, I really did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've met lots and lots of politicians over the years, as I'm sure you have as well. And, you know, the vast majority got into politics for the best of reasons. You know, they saw a local problem they wanted to fix, so they got on the city council, and they liked helping the community, and then they ran for state rep or something, and then Congress. You know, most of them are in it for the right reasons. So I think they would appreciate the perspective. But I have to say, the only politician I've really talked to about it was Mayor Bloomberg from New York City, who gave our commencement address last year, and the president of the college set up a meeting between myself and a couple of my colleagues and the mayor. And the president told him about the book. It was, you know, just coming out. And he said, I totally disagree. He said, I think,
interesting.
You know, he said, look, I think, you know, the example he gave, probably not surprising to many people, is gun control. And he said, look, we'd have sensible gun control if it wasn't for money in politics, if it wasn't for the NRA. And politicians, you know, want to stay in office so badly that they're you know, cowed by the NRA. So he had a pretty cynical view of why politicians behave the way they do, and that was a little disappointing to me. But you know, you're right. It's a common perspective even among politicians, and it's one of the saddest things to me is that to hear politicians bash politicians, you know, and bash politics. On the campaign trail in 2012, Mitt Romney was asked by a little girl what I think it was a little girl, it was a child, who said, you know, what should a young person do if they want to go into politics? And he said, run away, turn and run away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that sort of attitude, which is funny, you know, and it's endearing to the audience, I'm sure, but it really undermines faith in our system, I think. You know, it really does create the kind of cynicism that I'm trying to argue against. So that is really, yeah, to me, you know, quite disappointing that politicians engage in the same sort of thing.
Right. Now, before we started, you mentioned that you were just cycling off of your department chair service.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that we have another book to look forward to from you soon? What's next on your research agenda?
Well, I've just finished up second edition to my campaigns and elections textbook, and I'm now turning attention to a brand new project. So I'm in the very early stages, so there probably won't be a book for a while, but I'm curious to do even more work along the same lines of this book. And this book is largely polemical. You know, I'm making an argument here that I hope people will be open to, you know, that they or at least I think they should hear. But I really want to start to dig a little more deeply into this dissatisfaction with the system. And I'm becoming, as I said at the beginning, I'm concerned about people's dissatisfaction with politics and government, and I'm worried that it's becoming a dissatisfaction with democracy itself. And so one of the things I'd like to do, and I'll be on sabbatical in the spring, and I'm going to try to start this project, is I'd like to begin to investigate exactly how people understand democracy, what it is that they think democracy is, and how it should operate. And so really try to dig into democracy sort of as it's applied, you know, as it's practiced, to see what it is, and I suspect people are going to have the same kinds of, contradictory expectations about what democracy is and should be. But I think it's important that we understand, you know, what people mean when they say democracy. You know, how they think it ought to operate, and if they're consistent in their views about how it ought to operate, maybe we can reform the system to conform to those views and those expectations. Sadly, I think they probably won't be. I think they'll probably be fairly confused about what it requires and how it should operate, and I think there'll probably be contradictory expectations. I mean, that's my hunch, but I'd like to explore it by doing some survey work and doing some focus group work and really, really having long conversations with citizens about what they think about democracy.
Yeah, well, I look forward to that, and I enjoyed this book, In Defense of Politicians, The Expectations Trap and Its Threat to Democracy, published this year by Routledge, our good friends at Routledge. Stephen Medvick, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Heath. It was a pleasure.